Today is Thursday, August 23rd, 2018. It's 11:14, almost 15 in the morning. And I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record in the Today production studios of WGN Radio. We're going low rent here today, and I'm just a little upset about it, but I digress. You can hear me weekdays from 1 to 3 on WGN Radio, and Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN, and not nearly as pampered as John. I'm perfectly comfortable in the studio.
Yeah, I'm Eric Zorn. I'm just fine. I'm the guardedly optimistic and very comfortable columnist for the Tribune, and I appear several times a week in the paper. You'll have to find it.
So, Eric, why are you guardedly optimistic?
I'm guardedly optimistic because I think that this has been such a bad week for the president, and I think the president is such a bad president that this may end up bringing him down. I haven't thought that this was going to be possible yet. I'm still not sure, but it just looks really bad. He's now an unindicted co-conspirator in a crime.
He worked to pay money to silence two women who had information that he believed would be detrimental to the 2016 campaign and to the candidate and the campaign.
I think that voters, mainstream, sensible voters everywhere are going to reject that.
When you say bring him down, you mean he will eventually be removed from office?
I would have never thought that until this week, and now I think that he may not finish out his term.
For the first time this week, allowed myself just a little twinge, just a little guarded optimism, to use your words, Eric, and I haven't felt that way in a long time. It's a shame I have to feel that way about the possible impeachment or indictment of the President of the United States, but I thought, wow, everything they've been saying all along, all those fake news reports are true.
There was drama in that it came now. This has all been reported pretty much, but that it came in a federal courtroom before a federal bench with the federal defendant, you know, admitting it and saying that he got help from a candidate for president.
Yeah, I don't see how there can be any doubt at this point that Trump and Cohen and people in his inner circle conspired to pay off these porn stars, this playmate, to conceal his affair. And then they did it in a way that violated campaign finance laws.
Well,
there doesn't seem to be any doubt of that.
He said that it's not, not only are campaign violations not a big deal, but he said on Fox News and elsewhere that it's probably not even against the law what he did.
He did say that. He is not a lawyer, and I have not heard a serious lawyer say that on TV yet. That, I mean, this is a crime. What they did here, if he wanted to just pay these people off, he could have done it out of his pocket. You know, a billionaire could easily have done that, right? This is chump change, supposedly, to a guy like Trump. But they went through the campaign financing, they hid it, they created the shell corporations. You know, I don't see that a lot of his supporters are going to peel away. They knew when they voted for him that he was a dog. I mean, they had heard the Billy Bush tape. They knew all about the allegations that he had sexually harassed or assaulted numerous women, that he'd had all these affairs. This was baked into the price of Donald Trump. But when you start talking about breaking the law, that it's a bridge too far for, I think, a significant percentage of voters. And I don't mean a large percentage. I just mean a significant percentage.
You know, you think, Steve, it'll matter?
I wish I shared your optimism. I don't expect it to matter all that much. This was in the cake, right? We knew this. He had done this. It is significant that it is a part of the federal court proceeding, but it's going to take more than a campaign finance law, even though you're right that they did conspire to do this directly to help the election and that it came after the Access Hollywood tapes. I just think there's going to be more, need to be more than this.
And I tell you another reason I'm optimistic is that this has now become a case in state court in New York, and it's bleeding over into allegations about fraud and deception and all kinds of evil doings with the Trump Foundation. And, you know, is charity fraud and so on, where Trump was using, charitable money to pay off, to make payments for the things that have nothing
pay
to do
legal
with
legal bills, I think it was.
Pay legal bills having to do with the flag controversy down at
Create Time magazine covers of
Mar-a-Lago,
himself.
Yeah. and what that means is that this is gone beyond the federal jurisdiction, which means that there is that Trump's ability to stop this through pardons and so on and pulling the levers on the federal process is diminishing also. And I think that, you know, that's a big deal that Cohen was subpoenaed, I think, in state court this week. I think you're going to see this is a much harder trap for Trump to get out of no matter what he does. And I think he's in a situation right now. If he gets a pardon, to Manafort, and Manafort was convicted on 8 counts, and the jury hung on 10, right?
The reporting today by a lone juror.
But by a lone juror, this reminds me of the Blagojevich 1 trial. If you remember, the first Blagojevich trial resulted, I think, in one conviction for lying to the FBI and of, like, what, 17 hung counts?
Right.
And it turned out that it was one loopy juror who just didn't believe what she had been told and dug in that she wasn't going to vote to convict, and then they retried him and they convicted on the others. If this had been a seriously hung jury, if it had been like half and half, or if maybe most of the people or nearly all the people had wanted to acquit and there was one holdout, then you could justify what Trump said about how, well, gee, this is, you know, only 8 counts.
Well, why wasn't this jury sequestered? I don't understand that. When you've got, you know, Russian ne'er-do-wells sort of at the heart of some of this, you know, that they could try to pressure and do things. You had the president going on national TV and defending the defendant, which is never done.
Even in sort of routine criminal cases in Cook County, when the jury is deliberating, now they're not. It's very rare to sequester
during
a jury
for the entire trial.
Yeah. I remember the O.J. Simpson jury was sequestered for the entire trial. But usually during deliberations, jurors are sequestered. It didn't happen here. I don't know why. But
One other thing, you know, the president was on Fox this morning, and he's talking about now how flipping should be maybe illegal.
Campaign violations are considered not a big deal, frankly. But if somebody defrauded a bank and he's going to get 10 years in jail or 20 years in jail, but if you can say something bad about Donald Trump and you'll go down to 2 years or 3 years, which is the deal he made, in all fairness to him, most people are going to do that. And I've seen it many times. I've had many friends involved in this stuff. It's called flipping, and it almost ought to be illegal.
I'm sorry, don't laugh, John. It's the president saying this, that he says it should almost be maybe illegal. But in doing that, he talked about how Michael Cohen copped a plea to get a lesser deal. He didn't cop a... He didn't... There's no plea deal. He went in here and pleaded, right, naked, without any sort of agreement from prosecutors. There's no guidance on what his prison term might be.
But you might imagine that was his motivation.
Well, in his defense, there is a problem with jailhouse snitches and other informants and witnesses being offered really what amounts to substantial rewards for telling the stories the prosecutors want to hear. It is a problem in the legal system where, you know, it's Larry. I mean, it's not just as easy as saying, well, that's a crazy thing to say. It's not a crazy thing to say. It's not a crazy concern to have. It's someone would make up a story about another defendant or a co-defendant in order to get a lesser sentence. That's not a crazy worry. On the other hand, it is how you get true testimony out of people, and the truth does come out when you're saying, look, if you don't tell us the truth, then your co-defendant's going to tell us the truth, and one of you's going away for a long time, and then hopefully when they do start telling the stories, then the stories match up with other known facts.
And it matches up with other known facts. I mean, it's not like Michael Cohen is the only source of information on this. They had 4 million documents on his computer.
Could be that they've got everything they need without Cohen's testimony, and that's why they're not offering him a deal.
Another thing that makes me optimistic is that like at 1 a.m. yesterday, Trump, in all capital letters, tweets, "No collusion, rigged witch hunt!" ! And that's it.
It's like screaming out in the night, but on Twitter.
He opens up his window.
Go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore."
I mean, it is like demented in a way. He's so flop sweat all over that tweet.
Stop and think about that, because it is almost demented in the middle of the night, regardless of the time, unprovoked, unpart of any other sort of string of comments, right? Just to blurt that out without provocation. It's bizarre. I mean, we forget how bizarre everything this man does is.
Steve and I talked about this on the radio. I laughed out loud at Trump's tweet, and I've never done that before. He's a man devoid of a sense of humor. And I don't know if he meant to be funny when he said, "If anybody's looking for an attorney, I do not recommend Michael Cohen!" ! I don't know if that was him just saying, you know, hell yeah, or if he was seriously trying to impart some advice, or if he thought that kicking sand in Michael Cohen's face with that was really going to sting.
As many people have said, he is not behaving the way an innocent person would behave.
Well,
and so I mean, you draw these conclusions, and I mean, I think that this, first of all, I really believe at this point that the Democrats are going to take the House, and that there will be never-ending investigations of the president in the next 2 years in the House. There'll be hearings all day, every day about what's going on there. And I think it's going to drag him down. And I believe there's material there to impeach him, ultimately.
So do the Democrats run on impeachment?
Boy, they say they aren't. They say they're not going to. They say that that is not how to win the middle. Well, it's just shocking to me. I mean, I thought the strategy would be flip the House, impeach the president. At least you'd get the articles. Maybe the Senate doesn't convict. I'll bet they wouldn't. Certainly the current
at
Senate
this point, wouldn't. They wouldn't.
What do you need, 67 votes? They don't have 67 votes. But, right, is it 67 or 75? The Senate probably
two-thirds.
Two-thirds, 67.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they're going to be able to impeach him at this point. I mean, they can impeach him, but they can't remove him from office. And I'm not sure what the long-term gain of tying him up in impeachment proceedings
would
be.
Are you kidding me? Bill Clinton was impeached. That will always hang on him, and there's plenty of people that will always enjoy that fact. I think there's plenty of people who, knowing full well you wouldn't convict, would be happy to see the House drop articles of impeachment.
Yeah, but I think all the scummy around this administration right now is what you run on, and you run on the, you know, Duncan Hunter. Is it Duncan Hunter?
Yeah.
In California, who's blaming the Democratic Justice Department, which is ridiculous. You know, so you run on all of that stuff with the implication, right, that there may well be impeachment down the road. But if you run on impeachment, elect us so we can impeach him, that seems petty. Well, I think, especially when you're saying we should wait for the Mueller investigation to finish.
It's implicit in any Democrats' campaign right now for the House, which is that you're going to be a check on the president at the very least. I mean, that you have to make sure that you're building some guardrails. And I can't believe that there's a majority of Americans who don't feel that this president needs those guardrails. That if you're weighing a vote, say, out in the 6th Congressional District between Roskam and Kasten, this sort of somewhat moderate Republican, somewhat moderate Democrat, and you're thinking, okay, what do I want? Do I want to make sure that someone is in the House? I want to put someone in the House who's going to be a check on this president, this impulsive, narcissistic, arrogant, rash, dangerous president. Do I want someone to be a guardrail on him? I think the answer is yes for a substantial percentage of voters.
You guys haven't seen all of the videos I have. It's hard to keep up this week. But he's since put up three videos. One's 14 seconds long. One's 70 seconds long. He's standing in front of the White House. He's got that enormous suit on, the red tie. His hands are at his side, you know, barking out something that felt like, okay, good positive statement for me. Okay, let's do another one. Okay, let's do another one. One is that the Democrats are for ISIS, but I'm for ICE.
What I want to do is abolish the killers in ISIS. And you know who's going to win? We are.
14 seconds long. Boom. Okay, good. He just puts that on his page, like, okay, in the midst of all of this, I got that. Then he did the one about Molly Tibbetts and how this illegal alien took her forever from her family. And at the end of politicizing that horrible killing.
Right. We also need the funding for this year's building of the wall. So, to the family of Molly Tibbetts, all I can say is God bless you. God bless you.
You know what her family is saying to him is shut the F up.
Yeah.
They are really angry about him.
Her parents haven't, but her cousin and aunt and some of them.
But even the parents' initial statement, right? Parents. We know violence comes in all colors or something like that.
And when there's a mass shooting, it's too soon to make the point about gun control.
Bump stocks are almost illegal, right? We're going to get that done.
Someday we're going to get that done. And the idea that you know, that someone being taken away from their family, think of all the people in Las Vegas who were taken away from their family in part because of lax gun control laws. And they refuse to make those kind of connections.
Okay,
but to make the jump to an immigration argument, because inevitably immigrants, legal and illegal citizens, are all going to commit crimes.
I just want to say this. The lead story on Fox News. So Manafort is found guilty and Mueller or Cohen pleads guilty. That night at 9:32 in the evening, we've all had a chance to digest this and, you know, write up good stories about it. The lead story at FoxNews.com at 9:32 that night on their website is the Molly Tibbetts story. You know, within all the ancillary stories all around it. And you just can imagine that the juxtaposition of the guilty plea next to this story was beyond convenient for Fox News or for the president. I hate to characterize it as that, but suddenly they had something else to throw in front of it and say, no, this is more important. This is just a campaign violation over here. It's no big deal. We need to build the wall. I so wish that didn't happen for the girls' sake, for the family's sake. I wish there was more time in between the two stories so that they could each get the attention they deserve. Let's not, you know, imagine one through the lens of the other.
It doesn't matter what had happened that day. Fox News would have found something else to talk about at 9:32 at night. It could have been school dress codes. It could have been, you know, they would have found something. The Barnum and Bailey animal crackers taking the cage bars off the animal image.
That's more U.S. steel. That's American steel that's going out of.
Speaking of dress codes, Eric, did you just say dress codes?
I did.
The principal of King College Prep High School is evidently changing the school's dress code. The new dress code, according to the Sun-Times, will bar students from dressing provocatively as a necessary measure to help prevent sexual abuse in a Chicago public school. A parent played a recording of the principal saying as much to the Chicago Board of Education meeting. They'll say they'll look into it. But the principal said, why should we allow students to dress provocatively? She said, we've got this problem in the school, so we should not let kids dress that way. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I have two reactions. One is that I think that it is probably pretty good to have dress codes in schools that you need to make sure the kids aren't wearing pajamas and fuzzy slippers and bathing suits and so on to school. On the other hand, I think that linking attire to sexual assault and sexual abuse is victim blaming.
Especially when the abusers are adults.
Say she didn't use the sexual assaults as a reason for it. Would you crack down on provocative dressing if you saw it in the halls?
Yeah, maybe, but the fact is she did. I'm kind of with Eric. I can see dress codes and situations, but she did it in an unfortunate way.
Because she's assuming that if we dial it down, then there will be fewer sexual assaults.
And I don't know that there's any research that reflects that. Certainly, you need to have dress codes in schools, right? I think we all agree with that. You have to have. So the question is, how do you write them? How do you write them in ways that don't totally constrain students? And is it so bad? I mean, I would be fine with a uniform. Schools with school uniforms.
Too.
I don't think that that is a horrible abridgment on children's freedom. I think it probably makes the learning environment better. I haven't read the research. I mean, I haven't done any real background on this issue, but it does seem to me to be sort of fairly obvious that the school environment would be improved and more orderly with dress codes, and that it would be easier for parents and easier for students just to follow those, and then they can wear whatever they want on the weekends.
When I see young ladies dressed that way, I just think about their self-esteem, because to me, provocative dress, whatever that means in your mind, is sort of a call for attention. And if it's calling attention to your sexuality, then I think it just speaks to how you feel about yourself, that you need to advertise yourself this way as opposed to some other way. So I just feel sad when I see those situations. I know what the principal is thinking, that there's some knucklehead boys out there who actually will see provocative dress as a kind of come on. It's not the girl's fault. But some boys are aggressive or stupid enough to do that. So why is it bad advice to tell young men or women, young women or men, to not dress provocatively? That's the logic train.
I don't think it's bad advice at all. And I want to go back to your comment about girls and their self-esteem. I don't know that I agree with it. That's a sign of a problem with self-esteem. And I think there are a lot of young boys or men, adult men, who walk around trying to look good, too. And try to look attractive to women, and it just happens that it's a different look than what girls do.
I know that's thin ice that I'm standing on there. What about the Wilmette story, you guys? So, Eric, did you follow this?
I followed it, yeah. I mean, the story is that an 8-year-old girl was out walking her dog around the block by herself, and a neighbor called police.
And the police then investigated, didn't file charges or arrest the girl or the parents, but then DCF has to get involved
because by rule or by law
of child neglect or endangerment. And so DCFS then has to investigate the parents for letting their 8-year-old walk around the block, to which the question becomes, is it bad judgment on a parent's part to let an 8-year-old walk alone around the block?
I don't think so. I don't think that it is bad judgment. I don't want to be in a situation where people, when they see something that seems jarring to them, and I think the neighbor reported that she was five, and the neighbor misapprehended the age.
Told the police she thought she was five.
But in any case, you know, that you want to encourage people to, if they're concerned, to call in and say, look, I think there might be
a
problem here.
If you see something.
Yeah, if you see something. On the other hand, it seems like there's no reason to take a call like that up to 11. If a squad car comes around and the girl says, yeah, I'm walking the dog, and the mom says, yeah, it's fine, then it should end there. If I'm that girl's mother and somebody like sees this and calls it in and they check it out, I'm kind of grateful in a way. Some people have their eyes out for my kid. If all of a sudden I'm like under investigation and DCFS wants to come in and look at my house and, you know.
Which is what you are. Now.
And I think that goes too far. I think that common sense has left us.
Okay, I think you have a great point. Maybe the law should be changed or the apparatus should be to allow for more discretion. I'm not thanking this neighbor. If this neighbor is so concerned about my 8-year-old daughter who's walking around the block, she should get her ass out of the house and go ask the 8-year-old girl, not call police.
Are
about
you okay?
It.
I have not read what kind of dog it was. Have you?
I think it's a little dog. There's a picture in the paper. So.
Because if it was a big dog.
It was a cute dog.
Some 8-year-old.
It was a good boy. It was a very good boy.
I've seen some kids who have more dog on the end of a leash than they can handle. And that bothers me.
You know, that came up on your show yesterday. People called, and I get that. But, I mean, again, that isn't what happened. So we can only assume that this mother knows this dog and this girl's ability to walk the dog. That's not what we're not talking about an attack. That would be something different.
Yeah, it seems to me like that neighborhood is probably pretty safe. The number of kids who are snatched off the streets.
Thousands. There are hundreds and thousands every day, Eric.
In that particular suburb? No, I mean, even
in Wilmette?
Even in the U.S. I mean, it's just, you know, it's
not
that.
Millions.
I mean, certainly when all of us were 8 years old, we were out playing by ourselves or out in the neighborhood playing without supervision. And I'm not sure that things are that much more dangerous today, especially in places like the North Shore suburbs.
In fact, you have never lived in a safer place than
a
safer time.
It was probably more dangerous back then. My point is, you know, people complain about every kid wanting a trophy in softball or in kickball or whatever, and then they want they don't want kids to have any independence on their own. I mean, I think this mom is doing a good thing. Get this girl out into the world on her own, build some independence, build some self-confidence, so she won't be asking for a trophy when she's in 15th place.
Isn't it funny that in Wilmette, if a kid walks
was
around
that a reach?
The block...
15th place, wow.
I don't think 15th, but 5th for sure, Steve. Yeah. Good job. Isn't it ironic that in Wilmette, which has got to be one of the safest zip codes, right, in the United States of America, there's a kid walking a dog around the block, and DCFS investigates. A kid that age trying to survive on the South Side, you know, has nobody looking out for them. By the way, the governor, maybe we should ask the governors what to do on some of these issues. JB put $20 million more of his own money into his campaign.
The polls show him 16 points up over.
Is it 16?
That was the poll just
a Marist poll.
Yeah, it was an NBC Marist poll just a couple of days ago. So it wasn't one of these polls by the campaign, which are always a little suspect. But this was an objective.
Doesn't it bother you that somebody can put that much money into a campaign?
It bothers me that I can't put that much money into a campaign.
I'm sorry. I think that's fundamentally wrong. And maybe not in this case because they both have endless resources. But I just don't like that stacked deck feeling. How much money does Rahm Emanuel have in his campaign war chest? That matters.
He's got a lot more than his opponents, too.
Yeah, probably combined.
Probably, yeah. Almost certainly, actually. I mean, the influence of money in politics is really a problem, I think. I think when you have people who have that kind of megaphone, that kind of opportunity to speak, I believe we're going to see in this the governor's race very few debates. Their candidates are being very cagey about it. Rauner says he wants 10 debates, which Pritzker is, in some ways, Pritzker is going, well, come on, you wouldn't even debate your primary opponent,
right.
So, you know, get lost. Pritzker doesn't want to give Rauner any more ammunition. On the other hand, I think Pritzker owes it, I think both these candidates owe it to the voters to do 8, say, debates around the state to
talk
about
the
issues.
I would like to hear how they handle
themselves.
Hey,
that's a big number. 8 is a big number.
Nobody's going to watch 8, Eric.
No one's going to watch 8, but if they're all over the state, if you've got a debate in Rockford, you got a debate in Springfield, you got a debate in Carbondale, and this is very naive and it's never going to happen, but they owe it to the voters and the citizens to get together and to talk about their various policies and put each other to the test, put themselves in front of a panel of usually journalists who can ask some tough questions, because these ads they're running are just, they're uninformative, they're infuriating.
Yeah. One last question for you guys. When was the last time Chicago was as excited about a new athlete or any athlete as they are Michael Kopech? And is it as excited as I think it is? Because now I'm America's biggest White Sox fan, and they're on our radio station. It was so nice to see such a big crowd for this new kid called up to pitch for the White Sox the other night. He only got in two innings, but he struck out four guys, and then there was a rain delay, and they didn't put him back in. He didn't give up any earned runs, got himself into a jam. The first two batters got hits, but then he got out of the inning without a run scored, and then he did better in the second inning, and fans are really excited to see his 100-mile-an-hour fastball. He threw a terrific changeup. He dates a star now. He's got some personality, has a baby face. You know, he's a very interesting, dynamic package. And I'm just wondering, when's the last time people were so buzzing about some new athlete in Chicago?
I'm going to say Derrick Rose.
That's the one I was thinking of. Obviously, Kerry Wood comes to mind. But
Kerry Wood, eventually.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, not like this, not his first start.
Rose lit it up. People were so loving Derek.
And every time we get a new quarterback, of course, Bears fans go nuts. But I don't think there's been a quarterback that the Bears fans are truly excited about.
Right, that's exactly.
A little bit with Cutler when he came in, but
yeah,
I don't think
he was so obnoxious from the get-go.
But I'm thinking like Chris Bryant in his first game or things like that. It just wasn't, there wasn't as much made of it as there was this.
There was
one
quite
game.
A bit,
I don't know. I don't quite get it, frankly. I mean,
you don't.
Well, I mean, I hope he does really well, but I guess I do get it—the enthusiasm for it. But it's a long process. It's not like it's a
for
one
a long
game.
Time. We've been hearing about him. You know, and so you wanted to finally get a look at the damn thing.
I think it's different for a pitcher too than it is for an position player. You know, a position player comes in and may or may not have a chance. He will have three or four at bats, but if it's a pitcher, it's all on him from the get go.
Steve makes an excellent point that when a pitcher comes in, he's there on the mound. It's very exciting to watch. And the problem, of course, with pitchers is that there's this, you know, track record. Some pitchers are, these pitchers that are highly touted are really great, but some of them, you know, they snap their tendon at some point or they just don't have it.
I would put Taves and Kane in that, you know, universe of athletes that the city just so loves and has been so excited
about.
But
your first question was their first appearance.
Yeah.
And I think this is,
you just you hope that the White Sox have the intel, and you know that they do, is make sure that they don't burn this guy's arm out. I mean, it was very smart of them not to bring him back after that rain
delay. I would
have
brought him up next year.
You want to be really careful with him because this is basically training camp for him still. It's a big training camp.
Okay, so your recommendations for the week are something we're eating, watching, drinking, listening to. What do you recommend?
I went to see the movie Eighth Grade, and I really, really liked it. I thought the actress, Ellie Fisher, I think her name is, the young actress who plays the eighth grader, perfectly cast. The movie is excruciating to watch in some ways because it brings back every anxiety that you had in eighth grade and more. And I think the tone of it is perfect, and it's very provocative, and I really like it.
I'm going to recommend that parents of new college students stay out of their students' rooms when they come back from dropping them off, because it's very emotional and very sad, and I have some friends who are going through it. So just keep the door closed for a few weeks. It'll be better.
Yeah, and don't look in the top drawer of the bureau.
No, never look in the top drawer. No.
Don't know what you're going to find there, huh?
Yeah.
I watched the other night, I was clicking around and fell on my favorite movie and watched the whole damn thing. I was up till almost 2 in the morning, Big Night. Have you guys watched Big Night?
Oh, yeah.
No,
yeah.
I've seen it. What is it about?
It's about an Italian restaurant that's trying to make it.
It's two brothers. Tony Shalhoub and
Isabella Rossellini's in there, and Minnie Driver's in there.
It has to be early 80s, right?
And oh my gosh, Eric, this is in my wife and I always say, what's your top 10 favorite movies? Favorite movie. It's in our both top five.
Of course,
wow.
I've got it. I'm Googling it, but it came to me. Stanley Tucci.
Stanley Tucci, yeah. For goodness sakes.
And was this on a streaming service, or are you just channel surfing?
It on demand.
1996 it says.
Yeah, what a great movie.
Why don't we have Elif put that on the show page then? What were you?
I will, and it's a good food movie. You know, a movie that you watch and the food looks so good, you get hungry and you want to eat that food. This is one of the all-time great food movies.
And that's a great suggestion, The Big Night.
Thank you, Eric Zorn. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. I'm John Williams. The rest of our gang will join us next time. The Mincing Rascals are produced by Elif Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.